Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does evolution shape our day-to-day social interactions? And where is the line between behavior we choose and behavior governed by primal instinct? Our climb up the corporate ladder, our observance of the unwritten rules of elevator sharing, and the complexities of our relationships with significant others can seem galaxies apart from the behavior of our primate cousins in the wild. But my guest today finds we are equally compelled by nature to establish social hierarchy, find healthy and suitable mates, and ensure our kin are well-positioned to carry our genes to future generations. Dario Maestropieri is professor of comparative human development, evolutionary biology, neurobiology, and psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Games Primates Play, an undercover investigation of the evolution and economics of human relationships. Dario, welcome to Think.
Thanks. Hi, Chris.
Social interactions lie at the heart of human behavior and also at the heart of primate behavior. What sort of economic calculations play into what we do?
Well, in some cases, we make rational calculations. So we think about behaving in ways that is advantageous to ourselves, and sometimes this has a cost to others. But in many cases, we don't engage in these rational calculations. So particularly in social relationships, we behave in ways that is the product of natural selection. And essentially, natural selection in millions of years has made the rational calculations for us. So behavior that has evolved is typically advantageous for the individual and has low cost.
And in any given situation with another person, our first order of business is establishing a sort of social hierarchy that will allow us to fall into predictable patterns. So the dominant person can press their advantage and the submissive person can stay alive.
Yeah, dominance relationships are something that almost inevitably occur in relationships with people that we meet more than once. Mm-hmm. So obviously with family members, with coworkers, colleagues, friends, we tend to establish dominance, which means that if there is a disagreement, if two people want to do different things, the dominant person in the relationship gets to choose, essentially gets to have a greater influence in the decision process than the other person.
And so many of us in couples assume that there is no such thing in a relationship, but you think it's almost impossible for people to have a long-term relationship and not have one person be dominant and one person be more submissive.
Yes, I think that if I ask you to think about 100 social relationships that you have with people you know, starting with your family members, your spouse, your children, your parents, and then friends and colleagues, and then ask you whether you're dominant or subordinate in each relationship, I think that you would give me a good answer for about 95% of these relationships. Mm-hmm. Maybe 5% you wouldn't be sure. Maybe it's uncertain. But I think you would have a pretty good idea. You just don't think about it most of the time.
So what kinds of role pairs come up in our interactions? Because we can have a sort of parent-child relationship with someone who is neither our parent nor our child.
Yes. Well, obviously, parents have important relationships with their children, and these relationships change over time. Sometimes we have similar relationships with older people who sort of act as you know, adoptive parents. Same things with children. But all these relationships have something in common, which is that there's disagreements. On an everyday basis, two people, no matter what their relatedness is, whether it's biological or based on friendship, disagree. And so it's just too expensive to settle all these disagreements with fighting or negotiation. So dominance essentially saves us the cost, the stress of having to fight or negotiate all the time.
And typically we are not dominant or subordinate unilaterally. We might be in charge at home and not at work or vice versa.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Dominance is a property of a relationship, not of an individual, which means that you can be dominant in one relationship and subordinate in another. But there are some individuals who tend to be dominant in most of their relationships and others that tend to be subordinate in most of their relationships.
So most people, Dario, are familiar with primate grooming behaviors, but they don't seem to have anything to do with us because we don't stroke our colleagues' hair or remove bits of debris as a show of respect. But we do and can win them over with small talk.
I'm sorry, did you say?
We do try to win people over with small talk.
Yes, exactly. So small talk is the functional equivalent of grooming behavior. So in my book, I talk about how on a very long elevator ride, people initially who are with a stranger in the elevator will act indifferent, will pretend that maybe the other person is not there. But if the elevator ride is long, at some point they start doing making small talk. So it's a friendly behavior. So two monkeys in the same situation will start grooming. Essentially, it signals that there's not a hostile disposition.
It is interesting that unspoken rule that we all have, that if the elevator ride is short, without being told, we just know not to make eye contact in the elevator. And primates are the same way.
Exactly. So in most primate species, a direct eye contact is a threat. So if you go to the zoo and stare a monkey in their eyes, don't think you want to pick a fight with them. And I'm sure that if a stranger stares you down, you think the stranger has some beef with you. So in the elevator, we automatically, unconsciously try not to make eye-to-eye contact because it would be dangerous in that situation.
And then there's the question of how to handle the buttons. This is really interesting. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So a few years ago, I lived on a 20th floor of a high-rise building in Chicago, and there were so many different people who every day I met in the elevator. I noticed that sometimes when somebody walked in the elevator, I already pressed the button, for example, to go to the ground floor. This person would now look at me and would look at the button panel and see that the button had already been pressed, but press it again. So I wonder why. Why do people do that? And an answer they've come up with is that by doing that, they sort of don't acknowledge that you're there. So essentially say this person is not there, is not trying to go to the same place that I'm going. So it's just an easier way to deal with an awkward situation. Just pretend that the other person is not there.
So when it comes to things like small talk and chatting in that elevator or in another place where we don't know people well, what is the potential advantage for a subordinate putting so much energy into grooming a superior as opposed to the other way around?
Well, a subordinate individual in the presence of somebody who's potentially threatening essentially thinks that if there is a confrontation, he or she is not in a power position, a position of power. And so if there's a confrontation, the subordinate person thinks that he or she has more to lose. And so the grooming or the small talk essentially is a form of appeasement. You're trying to appease the other person and trying to minimize the possibility that there might be a confrontation.
So let's talk about our economy, which feels deceptively rational and devoid of emotion and is in fact a product of evolution.
Yeah, so people make decisions for many reasons. In part, they consciously, intentionally calculate the costs and the benefits of these decisions. But in part, we all have tendencies to behave in ways that are less rational, which are more the product of our biology. So, for example, we've done a study here at the University of Chicago showing that both men and women who have a higher testosterone tend to make riskier financial decisions, or they're more willing to take risks. So there's also a study done on Wall Street that shows that traders that have higher testosterone make riskier decisions. So you see how at the individual level, biological variables can influence the kind of decisions that we make.
And then when it comes to conflict, there's also that cost-benefit analysis. It really depends how much you have to lose and how much you have to gain.
Exactly. So you have to think, what is the conflict about? Typically, when we use theoretical models for analyzing situations in which there is conflict, we assume that two people disagree because they both want something. And so you have to analyze what is the advantage that each individual would get from obtaining whatever it is that they want, and what is the cost that each individual would have to pay if, for example, there is a fight. So depending on this relative balance between cost and benefits, one individual might try to threaten and escalate the fight, while the others might instead decide to appease the other and try not to get into a fight.
We all think about nature as being red in tooth and claw, as the famous quote goes. But talk about human beings and our tendency to kill other human beings as compared with other primates and the rates at which murders happen in those communities.
Yeah, so I think that human beings have a high potential for aggression and violence, which doesn't mean that this potential is always realized. I mean, we have the ability to exist peacefully with many people, and we do so. But to say that we have a high potential for aggression, it means that there might be situations in which our behavior is prompted towards aggression. So there are situations in which being aggressive, being selfish, being violent towards others is highly beneficial. We obtain a lot, and the cost is low. So we don't pay a high price. So in my book, I use as an example New York City. In the year 1977, there was a huge power blackout, and so the city was in the darkness for several hours. A lot of people who had no previous criminal record went out and looted stores and mugged people and robbed and even committed murder. So it's not because they were criminals, it's not because they were evil, but essentially the darkness reduced the probability that they would have to pay a price, that they would be punished for their crimes.
Hmm. And there's even those interesting studies about people dropping two quarters in the coffee honor box or the bagel honor box. And we behave very differently if there's a picture, a poster of some eyes looking down.
Yes, this is an interesting study that was done in a university in the UK a few years ago. It shows that when people perceive that they're being watched, even though this is not true, and it takes as little as an image of eyes on a wall, then we have the tendency to behave more honestly, to cooperate more, and to pay more money for our coffee. Whereas if we have reason to think that nobody's watching, then people have the tendency to be a little less cooperative and a little more selfish.
And I guess in some ways it really does make sense that when we think others are around, we are on our best behavior, because we have gotten as far as we have because humans often are highly cooperative and collaborative. We have to get along with each other to survive.
Yes, cooperation and competition are two equally important aspects of our social life. So we live in these complex human societies in which it's impossible to be successful without the help and the support, first of our family members, and second, our friends and our allies later in life. But also competition is a problem because there are so many unrelated people and there's not enough resources for everybody. So we need to cooperate with others essentially to compete against our enemies. So they're both equally important.
Do other primates behave differently if they have their friends around as opposed to when they are alone?
Absolutely, yes. There are other primate species that live in complex societies such as our own, and it makes a difference whether they're surrounded by family members or friends or whether they find themselves alone, for example, in the presence of their enemies.
Hmm. So talk about the ways that, for example, we think that nepotism is a really bad thing, but there is a sort of rational justification for it, even though we've decided that it's immoral.
So from a biological perspective, nepotism is simply behaving in ways that favors our family members at the expense of others. So obviously parents behave nepotistically whenever they invest in their children at the expense of maybe of other individuals. So nepotism is very natural. It's everywhere in nature. In all animal species, relatives tend to help each other against non-relatives. So, but in other animal species, there's no right or wrong. There is no morality. There is no good and bad. Whereas in humans, we have established rules. We have established social rules. We have laws. We have moral principles. And what happens with nepotism is that in the process of helping our relatives, we end up breaking the rules, essentially. We end up breaking the law, and we end up committing crimes. And that's when nepotism becomes dangerous.
My guest is primatologist Dario Maestropieri. His new book is called Games Primates Play, an undercover investigation of the evolution and economics of human relationships. We'd love to hear from you in this conversation. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dario Maestropiere, professor of comparative human development, evolutionary biology, neurobiology and psychiatry, and behavioral neuroscience at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Games Primates Play, an undercover investigation of the evolution and economics of human relationships. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Can you talk a little bit more, Dario, about how animals practice what we would call nepotism and sort of giving the advantage to their own kin?
Yes. I study a particular species of monkeys called the rhesus macaque. It's an Asian monkey that is commonly used also in biomedical research. These monkeys live in large social groups, and the females stay all their lives in the groups in which they're born, whereas the males leave their groups at puberty. There are steep dominance hierarchies in these groups, and offspring inherit the rank of their mothers. So what happens is that when these monkeys are very young, they get into fights with other young monkeys, and the mothers always intervene on behalf of their sons and daughters. So as a result of this intervention, which we can call a nepotistic intervention, essentially the outcome is that their children inherit the rank of the mother. So it's socially inherited, and it's transferred across generations so that any female who's born to a high-ranking mother will become a high-ranking female herself, and all of her daughters will be high-ranking as well.
How do you account biologically for altruism that definitely does not benefit our kin? Not even so much working within one's own community, but say sending money halfway across the world to victims of a disaster.
Well, in some cases, humans behave in ways that is genuinely altruistic. So we like to help others, and there's nothing mysterious about that. But in some other cases, this altruism directed towards non-family members is actually a form of business. So essentially, we behave altruistically because we expect something in return. So there is a system of reciprocal exchange of favors. And this is something that is actually quite common in nature as well. It's one of the most common explanations for altruism between non-relatives, that is an exchange of favors.
Yeah, there's an exchange of favors, and there's also potential status to be gained by publicly giving resources to other people.
Yes, one advantage of behaving altruistically, such as donating money, for example, to others, to charities, is that others will take notice of that. So there is a gain in reputation. And this gain in reputation might be advantageous. I mean, if you're a business person and you're looking for clients with whom to do business later in life, whether you have a good reputation for being a generous person, for example, can make a big difference, can help your business later on. So, yes, gaining a reputation can be very significant.
How do markets work in the animal kingdom?
We did not invent markets. Biologists have discovered markets in all kinds of organisms, from fish to insects to birds to primates. So the idea is that whenever individuals have to choose a partner, whether it's for social transactions, whether it's to exchange grooming behavior or some other form of affiliation, or it's for mating purposes, there's essentially a market in which some individuals have characteristics that everybody wants, and other individuals don't have these characteristics. And so essentially there are laws of supply and demand that determine which individuals are successful and which others are less successful. And in the end, the choice that we make of particular partners are dictated by these laws of supply and demand. It's essentially the same as things work in the human marriage market or human mating market, such as those on online dating services like Match.com.
And interestingly, this even works across species. And you write about these fish that have client fish.
Yeah, this is one of the most fascinating examples of markets in the animal kingdom. So there are researchers who have studied the dynamic of this market in which the small fish, as you said, swim inside the mouth of these larger fish, and they clean their mouth by eating their parasites. So there's a mutual benefit that is gained from this interaction. But some small fish, or some cleaner fish, are better than others, and some larger fish can be dangerous because after they had their mouth clean, they actually go ahead and eat the cleaner fish. And so there's issues of reputation as to who does a good job of cleaning and who does a good job of respecting the cleaner. And so there is a market there with laws of supply and demand that determine the choice of the perfect customers and clients for the business.
It really is amazing how much we have learned about the intelligence of animals that we didn't get before.
Yes, and it's not just intelligence. When it comes to social behavior, social relationships, essentially there are dynamics that are common across species because much of the social behavior evolved by natural selection, which means that whenever similar problems arise in different species, natural selection tend to come up with similar solutions, the solutions that work best. So, but by studying different species and comparing the behavior, we can actually learn what these general principles are, and then we can apply them to our own species and understand our behavior much better.
Is local culture a factor for animals in the same way it is for humans?
For some animals more than others, yes. For chimpanzees, for example, studies have shown that there are populations of these apes that differ from one another in terms of local traditions. So in some populations of chimpanzees in Africa, the apes use sticks to fish termites out of their nests, whereas in other populations, there's no such use of sticks for termite fishing. So this is due to the fact that in some places, the apes have figured out how to do this, and they've taught others. So the social learning has spread, and this behavior has become common. In other populations, nobody has figured this out, and so the behavior is not observed.
All right, let's talk about sexual and romantic relationships. What sort of unconscious calculation plays into the person we fall in love with?
Well, initially, I think love plays an important part in sort of starting a relationship. But also, a long-term relationship is a cooperative relationship. Two people get together because they have shared interest, and so initially, they have a lot to gain by being together and less to lose. But then later in life, things change, and sometimes this balance between benefits and costs changes. Sometimes the love is not as strong. And so we have to find ways to know whether our partner is still committed. And there's a theory in biology that suggests that many expressions of affection and love contain stressful elements because sort of stressing our partner out is a way of testing whether our partner is still committed to the relationship.
And is it macaques that perform something similar in a very different way that feels nothing like sex?
Different species of monkeys do similar things. For example, two male baboons who have formed a political alliance every now and then get together and fondle each other's genitalia. This is a risky, potentially dangerous behavior. It has nothing to do with sex. It's a social ritual with which essentially they check and make sure that their partner is still committed to their alliance. There's another species of monkeys called capuchin monkeys in which, again, two monkeys form a political alliance. They fight together against others. Every now and then, one monkey will walk up to another, stick a finger up their nose, and wait for a reaction. If the reaction is good, if there's tolerance and patience, it means the friendship is still good. But if the monkey who tries this gets smacked in the head, it means things have changed and maybe it's time to find a new partner.
So when humans are aggressive, one thing that has made it easier for us to wage war on others is that we have evolved these long-distance weapons.
Yeah. The problem with aggression, as with just with everything else, is that there's benefits and costs. So when we fight directly, there's the risk of injury, for example. But having invented projectile weapons essentially allows us to inflict harm on others without paying the cost because, you know, you can fire a weapon and hurt somebody at a distance without essentially risk any injury yourself. And it's even worse with nuclear weapons or bombs or missiles where people just essentially press a button and they kill, you know, many other people from distance without essentially paying a cost for that.
Mm-hmm. So logically we understand that they might retaliate, but in the moment there is no danger to us.
Exactly. And in some cases, the person who presses the button is actually unknown, and so there's even low risk of retaliation because the people who press the button sometimes make sure that their identity is not known.
Okay, so back to sex and love and partnerships. You mentioned Match.com earlier and the fact that that is very much a market. What can we see by looking at the patterns in which people find each other, in for example, in online communication?
So there are many studies that have looked at the dynamics of partner selection on websites such as Match.com. So the idea is that in the mating market, individuals have different endowments that make them attractive to the opposite sex. So, for example, women can be very appealing to men if they're young, if they're physically attractive, if they're well-educated. But it's mainly young age and physical attractiveness that makes women attractive to men. Men, on the other hand, also need to be relatively young and attractive, but women also find attractive wealth and social status in a man. So on a mating market, there are individuals who possess all these characteristics that make them attractive. They're young, they're beautiful, they're wealthy, they have high status. And there's others who don't have any of these things. And so there are individuals who are very popular and others who are not. So the result of this, of competition and of the laws of supply and demand, is that people end up being paired with somebody who is well-matched for their endowments. So the beautiful people end up together, and the people who are maybe less beautiful also end up being paired together, which is a good thing because everybody's happy in the end.
So everybody's happy at least for a few years. Talk about what biology tells us about the duration of committed relationships.
Well, so studies have been done about divorce rates and how many years after marriage people tend to get divorced. We're all familiar with the famous movie, The 7-Year Itch. Back then, there were some data suggesting that many couples get divorced after 7 years, but more recent analysis suggests that it's actually after 4 years. And so 4 years happens to be the interval between two subsequent births in many primitive societies. And anthropologists believe that for much of our evolutionary history, women had a child every 4 years. So we know that babies are high risk of mortality right after birth. So for a year or two, 3 years, they're high risk of mortality. But after that, then they're no longer at risk. So the idea is that maybe couples get together and have a child, and they stay together for about 4 years, which is the minimum amount of time to guarantee that the child will survive. But then after 4 years, they sort of reassess the situation. They see if they're still happy, and if they're not, maybe they break up and go look for a new partner.
So what does all that tell us about Brad and Angelina and Jennifer Aniston? I mean, people think Jennifer Aniston, who would leave a woman like that?
Well, I know that Jennifer Aniston wanted to have children with Brad, and they had bought a new house that had a nursery. But maybe they waited too long. Maybe they didn't think that their careers were advanced enough for them to settle down with a child. And I think in the end, maybe that was a mistake. Brad and Angelina had children right from the start, and children obviously can strengthen the bond between parents. And so that might be a factor that might explain why things have gone differently in the two couples.
How does testosterone affect men's tolerance for monogamy or interest in sort of playing the field?
So there's research that shows that how much testosterone a man has in his body is very sensitive to the social environment and, for example, to the relationship status of this man. So it turns out that men who are single and date frequently and change partner frequently tend to have very high testosterone. Whereas men who are in committed relationships, who are in a relationship that is stable, has been stable for more than 6 months, tend to have lower testosterone. And men who are married and have children have the lowest testosterone. So there are studies showing that when a man becomes a father, his testosterone drops dramatically.
So it's actually the relationship and the commitment to the family actually causes testosterone to drop as opposed to the other way around?
Yeah, essentially, investing in a child, you know, requires a certain mindset. So you're no longer thinking about sex or maybe being so competitive with others. And so this mindset essentially affects our body. There's a strong connection between mind and body. And so spending a lot of your time during the day taking care of a baby essentially will reduce your testosterone.
How does monogamy work in the primate world?
Well, there are some biologists who think that that monogamy doesn't really exist, meaning that they know that in some species a male and a female will form a pair bond that lasts for their entire duration of their life, and they call this social monogamy to indicate the fact that a male and a female live together. But when it comes to sexual monogamy, which means whether or not there is sexual exclusivity, then it's a different business because whenever biologists have done genetic studies to see whether the offspring of a couple actually belong to those two parents, it turns out maybe they belong to one parent but not the other because either parent was unfaithful in the past. And this has been shown in birds, in mammals, all kinds of species that are supposed to be monogamous.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Mahmoud who says, I've been reading current books on evolutionary psychology for a decade now. I wonder under what conditions is the assumption of generalizability of all primate behavior to human culture and vice versa verifiable? In other words, what example would one have to deduce from the index of human cultural practices that would violate the evolutionary psychology's basic assumption?
Evolutionary psychology makes many different assumptions. There's not one just general assumption that can be tested or discarded. Different primate species have different value in terms of comparisons with human behavior depending on what we're interested in. So I happen to be interested in social relationships. So there are highly social primate species that are more valuable for these kinds of comparisons. There are primate species that tend to be solitary, so they're not good comparisons for humans for that. If you're interested in comparisons of intelligence, then the most intelligent primate species, such as chimpanzees and other apes, those tend to be more valuable. So it's not that all primate species are equally valuable. Each species can be valuable depending on what aspect of human behavior and intelligence we're focusing on.
Dario Maestro-Pierri is my guest. He is professor of comparative human development, evolutionary biology, neurobiology and psychiatry, and behavioral neuroscience at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Games Primates Play, an undercover investigation of the evolution and economics of human relationships. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, email us at think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Primatologist Dario Maestro-Pierri is my guest. He teaches and does research at the University of Chicago, and he's author of the new book Games Primates Play, an undercover investigation of the evolution and economics of human relationships. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Kelly on the line in Dallas. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I was just curious if he's done any study around monogamy in the homosexual world.
Have you looked at that, Dario?
There are studies that have compared homosexual relationships and heterosexual relationships, and there's no big differences. So it's not that homosexual relationships are more or less stable than the heterosexual relationships. Essentially, people have a tendency to behave in long-term relationships regardless of their sexual orientation. So if a person is oriented toward long-term relationships, if a person wants to be in a long-term stable relationship, it doesn't matter whether the partner is a male or a female. So, and if a person likes to be promiscuous and change partners, that can happen with the same-sex partner or the opposite-sex partner. So it's more an issue of individual differences in propensities than an issue of sexual orientation.
So are the timelines the same as well for relationships sort of being on the, on the dividing line between staying together and breaking apart?
Well, there are no good data on divorce in homosexual couples, because until recently there was no formal marriage. Mm-hmm. But now in some states where marriage is now allowed, then soon, I guess, we'll have data on divorce, and then we can ask that question.
Okay, so let's talk about work, which is clearly an environment that is full of social hierarchy. Without ever looking at an organizational chart, what could you tell by just human interaction about who is in charge?
So in the workplace, there's dominance hierarchies, just like any other human social organizations. So you can tell who's at the top and who's at the bottom by the way people act. For example, if you look at people in a company sitting around a table having lunch, I can tell after a while probably who's the boss and who's not by their looking behavior, whether they act in a way that is self-confident, whether they speak a lot or not, or keep quiet. So there's dynamics that are evident in nonverbal behavior, and also when people talk to one another, you can work out the whole hierarchy.
And there's some really interesting research that's been done about something as simple as an email string that can predict a lot about where someone is going in one's career.
Yeah, you might think that when we communicate over email, or over the internet with Facebook, it's a totally different way of communicating from other primate species or from the way we communicated in much of our evolutionary history. But in fact, I think that's not the case. There are patterns, there are rules that regulate how email is exchanged. So for example, typically there is an exchange of emails when one person sends a long unsolicited email to another, and then the second person waits a while before replying and then replies, and then the emails go back and forth. I think that who starts the exchange, how long the delay is between replies, how long these replies are, these are not random factors. I think that these can all be explained by the relative difference in dominance between the two people. Typically, the person who's lower in status between the two is the one who starts the conversation, is the one who starts to write longer emails. The one-on-one tends to delay the replies, and the replies tend to be shorter. This is exactly the kind of dynamic that we see in primates when two individuals exchange grooming behavior. So the low-status individual does most of the grooming, grooms more quickly for longer periods of time. So, again, it all comes down to a different balance of costs and benefits.
So I know you're not in the business of giving career advice, but should people who want to move up think about changing their style of emailing?
It's possible. Sometimes the way we act sort of sends signals to others. So showing others that you're self-confident, that you're assertive, the way you talk, the way you present yourself, and maybe the way also you write emails sends a positive message. And so this may help in your career. Not necessarily, but it's something.
So one of the ways that we as humans make sure that everybody follows those unspoken rules of social interaction is by how much we accept them, whether they're welcomed into the group, whether they're shunned, whether they're gossiped about, or the subject, gossiping about others. How does that work in the primate world? Are there corollaries?
Yes. So one general problem of life in a complex social society is that you need to have information about other individuals. Okay, if you live in a group of 100 individuals, everyone has a relationship with everybody else. To be successful, you need to find out what's going on, who's friends with whom, who's enemies with whom, who's sleeping with whom. And so sometimes we can't acquire this information directly. So in humans, we acquire it through gossip. Essentially, gossip allows people to exchange information about third parties so that we know who's faithful, who's not faithful, who's got a good reputation, who has a bad reputation. Primates use grooming for similar purposes. So they engage in grooming behavior with many individuals, and from that they gather how friendly they are, whether they can be trusted, whether they're good reciprocators or not. So they gather all kinds of useful social information from this behavior.
What do you think is the reason for our interest in celebrity culture?
That's a good question. in many ways, celebrities do everything that we would like to do in our lives, except that the life is public.
Mm-hmm.
So it's taken to an extreme. Obviously, sometimes we don't have the money to live in these luxurious homes or to travel around the world and sort of live the extravagant lifestyle that these people live. So in many ways, they have all the things that we want, and because we can't live that life, sort of we live it vicariously through them.
Mm-hmm.
But indirectly, this interest in other people, in their lives, I think originates from our desire just to gossip, just to know what other individuals are up to and sort of get a sense of what's going on out there, because that affects our lives.
So beyond the subordinate grooming behaviors, do subordinate primates do anything to sort of imitate the ones who are at the top of the social heap?
No, I wouldn't say that they try to imitate the ones at the top. Sometimes they if they're ambitious and they want to climb the hierarchy quickly and get to the top quickly, sometimes they side with powerful monkeys. So they follow them and they help them in fights, even though these dominant individuals don't need their help at all. So they follow them around. Maybe sometimes they try to use similar social strategies, but it's not that they imitate their behavior on a sort of very detailed basis or anything like that.
I have to wonder, once you begin studying primates and looking, of course humans are primates, and looking for similarities, in terms of the way we look at each other, the way we move our bodies in a certain interaction, is it impossible to turn that off?
It is impossible to turn it off, yes. if you have observed primates for an enough period of time, and then you just notice all the same things in humans, and I mean, you get used to it. You're not surprised anymore. Initially, when you start noticing things, you're very surprised, and in the end, you just accept it, but you can't turn it off.
It's strange that we are able to see it, we who are not in your business, are able to see it in other animals and say, oh, they're so much like us, but we don't feel like perhaps we're like them.
Yeah, well, humans have always had the tendency to think that we're unique, that we're different. There's all kinds of philosophical reasons for that. Philosophers for centuries have tried to explain why humans are unique. So having a big brain creates a lot of problems, and one of them is we have to justify our existence. And so one way to justify our existence in the universe is to think that we're special, that we're different. Otherwise, it would be harder to find justification if we're just one of a million animal species on the planet.
I don't remember seeing this in the book, but I'm wondering if there's any evidence in the primate world of the existence of anything like the autism spectrum, where there are certain lower primates who can't figure out these social interactions in the way that others would.
Well, there is variation in social competence. So there are some individuals who are more socially competent than others. So, for example, they have more friends, they're more popular, they attract the attention of others, so they receive a lot of grooming from many other monkeys. And others who are less popular, they're less likely to engage in social play or other forms of social affiliation. We don't see in natural populations of monkeys something that resembles what sort of clinical autism. But there's clearly variation.
To what extent do the rhesus macaques that you study try directly to communicate with you, and how do they do that?
Well, all primates, if you go to the zoo and you spend a couple of minutes standing in front of an exhibit with some monkeys and apes, will probably try and engage the person in some kind of communication. For one thing, our facial expressions are very similar. So just like we can read their emotions in their faces, we can tell whether a monkey is angry or scared. They can tell whether we're angry or scared. So as a piece of advice, if you ever find yourself in a jungle and you're being threatened by a monkey, don't show them that you're scared, because they can read that emotion in your face and will encourage them to threaten and possibly to attack you.
How do you not show them that you're scared? What do you do with your body? You just like whistle and stroll away?
For example, you can act assertive. Mm-hmm. You can make eye contact. You can stare them down. You can also make noise. You can scream at the monkey. I got myself out of risky situations by essentially starting to yell at the monkeys that were threatening me and essentially scaring them with the loud noise that I make.
So what do we do with all this information in order to sort of appeal to our higher natures and do the right thing and maybe be more ethical and more moral than even our biology would drive us to be?
So I always tell people that the biology is not destiny. So the fact that we discover that we have biological propensities in our behavior, that doesn't mean at all that our behavior must be dictated by these propensities. So in the end, we're capable of making choices. We're capable of deciding the kind of societies we want to live in. We create rules and laws. We decide what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. But I think it's important to have knowledge of these propensities if they exist. So I think it's important to know human nature, just to know what we're dealing with. The fact that in some situation we know that we have certain tendencies to behave in certain ways, even if these tendencies are not socially acceptable. We're in a better position to control them and to change our behavior if we know where our behavior comes from.
That's a really interesting point, because a lot of people, or there are people who will argue that if you are sort of pushing back against something that you are wired biologically to do, you're fighting a losing battle. It doesn't sound like you think that's necessary.
No, not at all. That's a big mistake. Behavior can be changed. These days, there's technology even to change our genes, to change our brains, to change everything in our body. So anything can be changed. But it's important to know how our bodies are built, how our brain is built, how our brain functions, and it's important to know how our behavior works. So behavior has rules just like everything else, and we might decide that we don't like certain aspects of our behavior, that we want to change it, but knowledge is always the key. You always have to start with some knowledge of how things work to be able to change them.
The last thing I want to ask you, and this is sort of unrelated, but in terms of conservation of natural habitats for some of these animals that you study in the lab, are there things that we can do that makes certain that they will have a place to live in nature?
Yes. Well, you can support conservation organizations, for example, through donations. You can support, for example, movements to ban the use of endangered species as pets, or business which involves dealing with these endangered species for whatever purposes. So, just raise sensitivity about conservation issues. So, letting people know that many of these primates are at risk of losing their habitats. Maybe our children or grandchildren will not be able to see them at the zoo in a few decades because they'll be extinct. And so we need to do everything we possibly can to make sure they don't go extinct.
Dario Maestropieri is professor of comparative human development, evolutionary biology, neurobiology and psychiatry, and behavioral neuroscience at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Games Primates Play, an undercover investigation of the evolution and economics of human relationships. Dario, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
You're welcome.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.